So hi everyone, my name is Kasia Krzyżanowska, I am the editor of the Review of Democracy. It is my pleasure today to welcome Nick de Boer, assistant professor in constitutional law at the Amsterdam Law School. Just recently, he has published his first and excellent book titled Judging European Democracy, The Role and Legitimacy of National Constitutional Courts in the EU, published with the Oxford University Press. And today we will talk about the essential themes of this book. So welcome very much, Nick.
Yeah, thanks very much. Great pleasure to be here. And thanks a lot for the opportunity to speak about my book.
Sure. So let's go to the first question directly.
Yeah.
So generally, your book poses an essential question on the Constitutional Court's role within the European integration process. The book's main argument is that the National Constitutional Court's review of European law frequently risks constraining and narrowing democratic debate over the EU's constitutional underpinnings. So what were your main inspirations to write this book? And what kind of new insights does your book bring in?
Yeah, thanks a lot for your question. So I deal in the book with what I say is Constitutional Court's review of European law. So this is EU law, review of EU law, but also maybe broader. It's like when Constitutional Court says something about a new EU treaty that hasn't yet into force, or sometimes even an instrument on the international law that is closely related to the EU, such as the ESM treaty. Now this, I think the role of these constitutional courts in the EU has been a topic for debate for a really long time. There's a lot written on it. And you see also, for example, this debate emerging in the context of major judgment, like the PSPP judgment of the German Constitutional Court in May 2020. And there's also discussions, for example, about abuse of this position, like regarding the Polish Constitutional Court. Now, my sort of idea or inspiration to write this book is I thought the current way that we're looking at the role of constitutional courts maybe doesn't really fully take into account sort of the position of these courts in relation to other political institutions, I would say. So you could say, sort of, if you summarize the literature on constitutional courts in relation to the EU very bluntly, you could say sort of two big ideas. One branch of people says, you know, this review by constitutional courts of EU law and European law more broadly is a bad idea because it threatens the EU legal order, it threatens primacy. So you can see this, for example, in the position of the European Court of Justice. And there's then more than maybe the more recent idea, there's also the possibility of abuse by sort of captured constitutional courts, which is maybe the Polish example was the best example of that. Other branch of the literature, very influential, I would say, sort of comes under this bracket of constitutional pluralism. So that's been a very influential way, I think, of looking at the role of these courts and more generally the relationship between national constitutional law and EU law. And I think there's some various ideas in there. So one idea is if a constitutional court sort of challenges EU law, this promotes contestation or dialogue. You could also say it leads to respect for constitutional diversity or respect for identity of constitutional orders. Some people say this is a counterforce to the European Court of Justice. That's something that, for example, like Dieter Grimm, former constitutional justice of the German Constitutional Court, really says. And even some people have said this review by constitutional courts maybe has a democratizing effect on the EU. So because constitutional courts challenge the authority, so to say, of the EU, on constitutional grounds, it could lead to a further democratization of the EU, which is, of course, known to have a sort of democratic deficit. Now, sort of my thinking was, yes, these are really interesting positions, and I see the sort of force in them, but it doesn't really take into account the role of these courts in relation to the political institutions, particularly legislatures. So maybe to make that more concrete is, if you, for example, think that dialogue is a really great idea, my sort of hunch is you also need to consider who is doing the talking, right? So if we want to resolve big fundamental questions in the EU through a dialogue, then it matters who is talking. And it And my sort of intuition was it can't just be a conversation between constitutional courts and the Court of Justice. And also, if a constitutional court says that, like, there's certain limits, for example, to European integration, or there's certain things that the EU cannot do, I would say, yeah, that is a sort of contestation, but it, of course, limits political actors to decide on those issues. So this is kind of my, I saw a sort of tension in this literature, or the tension in the positive evaluation of constitutional courts that we have in the literature. So I thought, okay, how are we to think about their role if we actually take this relation to political actors very seriously, put it centrally? And that led me to ultimately a very sort of critical appreciation of what some constitutional courts, at least in the EU, are now doing.
Sure. So thanks a lot for this overview of all the themes that your book touches upon. But let us focus more on the positive evaluation of constitutional courts within the European Union.
Yeah.
So, how do you resolve the classic constitutional question? So, is the constitutional court really better equipped to provide a more reasonable resolution of constitutional interpretation of constitutional norms? I already see that your answer will be not really. But then, under what circumstances the constitutional courts should be deprived of its power to resolve core constitutional questions so that the legislature can decide?
Yeah, so that's a super, I think, really interesting question. And so in the book, indeed, I have a large chapter devoted to this classical debate on judicial review and the democratic legitimacy. So maybe it's good, I guess, to start with the criticism of people that criticize judicial review of legislation. So constitutional courts are, of course, in a way special. They have authority to say of democratically enacted legislation that it goes against the Constitution. Now, the argument against that is that this is a democratic problem because it allows judges to override the assessment of legislatures on the basis of quite indeterminate norms that we have in the Constitution. So if you put that down without much nuance, it would certainly the critic would crit critique would be it leads to judges being taking sort of political decisions. Now, so I think the critique rests on two sort of broad ideas. One is there is lots of possibility to reasonably disagree about constitutional issues, and most of the debate centers on fundamental rights. So there's debates, we can reasonably disagree about what freedom of expression means. Should it maybe prohibit hate speech or not? There's reasonable disagreement about whether what something like human dignity requires. So there's a host of disagreements that you can have about how to best protect these fundamental constitutional principles. So, and the critique is then if a court decides these issues, they will often take sort of a position in a reasonable debate, and they will and do that at the expense of the assessment made in the by legislatures. And then there's an additional argument by judicial review critics. They say that courts are not necessarily better equipped than legislatures to deal with these questions, because one argument, for example, is courts often focus on quite technical legal reasoning. So actually, the moral stakes in these debates are not always so prominent in these court judgments. And of course, courts may be not so good at embodying diversity of views. Whereas legislatures say, or the argument is that, and this is an argument particularly made by people like Jeremy Waldron and Richard Bellamy, political constitutionalists, they say legislatures can represent diversity and a diversity of opinions. And often our politicians will act reasonably. That's the claim. And citizens generally will be reasonable because they generally are committed to the idea of fundamental rights and the foundational principles of the Constitution. They just disagree, reasonably disagree about them. Now, so the claim I make a bit in my book is that, so these are sort of powerful arguments, but at least one issue with them, you could say, is that the debate is in large parts also empirical. So there's lots of claims about how legislatures and how courts function. And many people will probably doubt that politicians will always behave reasonably, right? And that citizens have a generally firm commitment to fundamental rights. And I think what is interesting about this theoretical debate is it doesn't, it's not always so clearly informed by these sort of empirical insights. So most prominent cases, for example, someone like Jeremy Walden, who has written the core of the case against judicial review, very influential article against judicial review. He only refers to one example in the United Kingdom. So one example in one country from a specific time period to say that legislatures will behave reasonably. So my assessment is that, yeah, you can, you could still say judicial review is justified if you can show, for example, that legislatures don't always behave so reasonably as this theory would suppose, and then you would need a necessary correction by a constitutional court. So I started, tried in the book then to delve deeper into sort of that question, but then specifically in relation to the EU. So I really tried to understand better how do political institutions really deal with the core constitutional questions about the EU, and how does that compare with the way that constitutional courts have tackled these questions.
Yeah, we will talk about these empirical insights that you managed to receive from your work later on in our discussion. But let me have a follow-up question on that specific topic. So what is the claim to conduct a weak form of judicial review? What does it mean for a judge to conduct such a weak review? What does it mean for her embeddedness in political debates on the domestic level?
Yeah, so one of the ideas that indeed came has come forward in sort of constitutional thinking as a solution to the democratic problem of judicial review is the idea of weak form review. And you have this in a number of systems around the world, such as the Canadian system or the system of the United Kingdom. And the idea is a bit that, yeah, you should maybe have judicial review of legislation, but it's ultimately either up to the legislature to decide what to do with the court finding, or a legislature is in a position to still override the assessment of the judges. So the latter example, so the override is the Canadian system, where at least formally the legislature has a would have a right to override Supreme Court opinions. And in the United Kingdom, for example, you have more of the declaration of incompatibility, where the court can say, yeah, we think that this law violates fundamental rights, but it's then up to politicians to do something with that. So this, the advantage of that system, at least in theory, is that it still gives you as an individual a right to challenge particular legislation and say, look, this legislation infringes my fundamental rights in my particular situation, and I want to be able to voice that concern and have an impartial judge look at that. But it sort of avoids the democratic problem because it leaves the last word to legislatures. So ideally then in such a system, a court would be more of a contributor to these fundamental constitutional debates rather than a sort of endpoint of the discussion. That is the ideal, but it of course depends on the idea that politicians or legislators will take seriously these judgments and are willing to reflect on these constitutional matters in a principled way, you could say.
Let us now maybe discuss the European dimension and leave the theoretical discussions, because they are broad and you discuss them broadly in your book as well. So coming to the European debates, this is a story known to the historians of EU law, but also to the constitutional law scholars. So we know that with the arrival of the Zolange case law, the national constitutional courts reserved the right to review EU law as long as a higher standard of human rights protection was guaranteed on the national level. However, with the enactment of the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights, deemed as providing sufficient protection standards by the German Constitutional Court, it is no longer the issue. The problem now regards the EU democratic legitimacy problem. And again, these are constitutional courts that attempt to remedy the democratic shortcomings of the EU. But you argue that courts, and I quote, risk constraining legitimate political decision making in this role. So why should we be worried of judicial review of European law on democratic grounds?
Yeah, so that's maybe a bit paradoxical questions as well, right? So on the one hand, the constitutional courts might claim we're actually protecting democracy, and therefore it seems a bit strange to say, oh, this is actually a democratic problem that that a court tries to protect democracy. So my analysis is here again, democracy in itself is a very open standard, and that can be interpreted in many ways, and I particularly. Maybe to focus this on the EU, I think there is sort of there is of course this whole debate about the EU democratic deficit, and I certainly agree with certain problems in the EU setup. But there's also fundamental disagreement, I think, about how to assess the EU democratically and what the best way would be to change the situation. So I think the best example, I think, or the best way to understand the debate for me is the difference between sort of an intergovernmental approach or the more democratic approach and a sort of more federalist idea. So if you believe that democracy is something essentially national because you need like national media organizations, national parties, what some theorists would call a national public sphere, and also that you need a shared identity and a shared language to have a fully functioning democracy, you'd sort of be skeptical, I think, of transferring too many powers to the EU. And you might be skeptical about how much a European Parliament could achieve. So sort of making the EU into something like the nation state with a parliamentary system would probably not be the best idea then in your perspective. It would rather be actually, no, the institutions that represent the nation states should be in charge. So this would probably lead you to like a more intergovernmental vision of the EU, ideally from a democratic viewpoint, where the Council and the European Council would be the main driving seat, maybe subject to more parliamentary control by the national parliaments. But because the democratic legitimacy of the EU then really derives from the nation states, it would be those institutions that would be at the forefront. Now, other people would say, no, actually, this in itself creates all kinds of democratic problems, right? It leads to what some people say is executive dominance. It's basically giving executives the main say. Or it leads to, you could argue, it leads to a lot of high majority requirements, which then in turn empower institutions like the Court of Justice. So some people say, if you actually want to make the EU more democratic, you need to put more power in the European Parliament and have a sort of parliamentary system at the EU level. So these are both democratic assessments. I think they both have, you know, they're reasonable views, but they lead in a way to opposing ideas, right? So for one view, the strengthening of the European Parliament would be somewhat undemocratic because it was likely to take power away from the nation states and the government. Whereas in the other view, that's precisely what you need to do. So then coming to courts, then of course, if a court is using democracy as a standard review, it's very likely to take a position in these debates. So, and the question is, can it use democracy as a review to avoid these kind of debates? Or is it then actually taking ultimately a sort of political position on a really fundamental one of the most fundamental questions about the EU and the nature, the kind of body that it is. So this is the kind of dilemma I see. So because there is fundamental disagreement about how the EU should be democratized, I think we need to work out maybe in democratic politics itself, in the political branches that we have, what we think about this. And I also think that actually sort of traditional party positions it matters the type of ideology I think you adhere to, matters for the way you look at this question. So if you are really pro-markets and quite liberal in this respect, then you are more likely to favor an EU with limited set of competences focused on on an internal market. But if you are, say, a social democrat or you are a green politician, then you might want to have a much more powerful EU that can do all kinds of redistribution, market correction, or you, if you're green, you want lots of climate action. So thank you. And also I often make maybe as a final example, I sometimes give, I think about, for example, different positions of people. So if I think, for example, about my grandmother, who's very old now, so her use of English is very limited, right? So the idea that she would be able to fundamentally connect to a European body at the EU level is very difficult. So for her to be a real democratic citizen, it's much more likely that she'd be able to play that role connecting to the Dutch parliament in the nation state context. But for me, it's very different, I guess, because my English, I think, is reasonably okay. And I care about all kinds of European issues. I have a fairly international family. So there's different positions in this. So, and I think we need to understand all the different interests and values that come within this debate. And if you had to get a court deciding these issues, the risk is that you actually have a court deciding for us the answer to all these debates. Yeah.
Thank you for bringing this debate on constitutional questions to the family level. I think it's an important insight and sometimes not taken or not really taken into account when we discuss constitutional law. But let me discuss some possibility that is looming on the horizon. So can you envision the situation in which the constitutional courts will review the revised version of the treaties on the European Union? And for example, declare that some of these provisions, like the lack of unanimity in some areas, declares it as unconstitutional or not compatible with national constitutions. So what's next? What's the problem? Like, do you see any problems, for example, if constitutional courts are somehow aligned with the national legislatures on this matter? And what if not?
Yes, so I guess my conclusion is that constitutional court should have a very limited role in relation to the EU. So I was trying to think, okay, so what are, for example, ways in which the constitutional courts maybe contribute fairly uncontroversially to the legitimacy of the EU? One of the ideas I developed in the book is sort of a minimal democratic review. So we could say, for example, they shouldn't determine this debate between, let's say, intergovernmentalist and more federalist ideas. But maybe they could say if there's executives operating at the EU level and they're making decisions, they should be subject to parliamentary control, whether it be a national parliament or a European parliament. Or they should maybe be transparent in their decision making so that we can actually democratically debate these decisions. So that's a kind of minimal review. I would think you could say that a constitutional court could maybe do. But I would be hesitant to say they should do much more. There is, of course, also the possibility that somehow there will be sort of right-wing populist wave in Europe and we get a significant increase in more authoritarian, say, governments. And then the EU maybe becomes a very unreasonable organization, so to speak. And then I would say maybe, okay, then a much more forceful role by constitutional courts in protecting this sort of constitutional democratic minimum will be more important. But I think in the current situation, it will often make these courts, constitutional courts, that they'll get embroiled in sort of what I would say is difficult political assessments. So their role should be minimal. But I can envision a sort of future situation where National Constitutional Court takes this step to actually declare, say, a new treaty unconstitutional or the, I don't know. So think, if you take the example of the German Constitutional Court, what they've always done is say, there are certain limits to European integration, but this treaty is fine. But if you maybe take these further steps, then you are, you're crossing a sort of so-called red line. But it's always a bit vague where these red lines are. So there's always quite a lot of flexibility, I would say, in it. For me, I think my assessment is a bit, if a court would do that, it would put itself in a very complicated situation because it were to sort of catalyze a kind of constitutional crisis and maybe put its own position in danger. And I think with you already saw this with the PSPP judgment of May 2020. So the German Constitutional Court there declared, of course, ultra-vires, an act by the European Central Bank, and also a judgment by the European Court of Justice. And there was quite, I think, quite significant sort of backlash to it. Lots of discussion, contestation. And I think what is more likely to happen is that this will lead to a more careful court and maybe also change in composition of courts over time, which will make it more moderate. So that's the more, I would say that's the most likely scenario.
Thanks for that. We can now discuss something that is already a topic of political debates in the national contexts. So, constitutional identity, because the Treaty on the European Union stipulates that the EU should respect the national identities of its member states, but then it does not mention the ways of paying this respect. And it was a matter of practice that actually the European Constitutional Court assumed the role of guardians of national constitutional identities. So my two questions will be posed here. The historical and normative one. So first, how did the process of proclaiming constitutional identity by constitutional courts look like? And second, show the definition of the core constitutional principles that are part of national identity, which is a seemingly political task, be developed by constitutional judges? And if not, how can we envision dividing this task between constitutional courts and other institutions?
Yeah, so very interesting question, also complicated maybe. So I guess the historical question, I must confess I haven't looked at the historical development of the idea of constitutional identity so much in detail. But so in a way, I would say that the answer from constitutional courts, I think, and perhaps particularly the German Constitutional Court, is they would say, yeah, it's sort of self-evident that we rule on constitutional identity because constitutional identity is the fundamental principles of our constitution, and we have the authority to rule on the constitution. So Article 4.2 of the Treaty on European Union is in a way not so relevant because EU law does not confer the competence on or the authority on constitutional courts to do this. It's actually, if you look at, for example, really the German Constitutional Court, they say it's rather the other way around. Like there are certain unamendable principles of the German Constitution, and not even EU law can derogate from them. So we can always say something about this, you know. And I guess so. Maybe for other constitutional courts, you could say something similar. I would say maybe the Italian Constitutional Courts, although they historically they haven't always used the notion of constitutional identity. So they spoke about these counter limits or controlimiti in the constitution. There, I think it's similar, maybe that there are certain essential constitutional principles of the constitution that they just see it as their task to protect. So there, I think for them, I guess it's sort of evident that you protect the constitution. And then sort of my position is a bit, yeah, you should maybe leave it indeed to political actors, or at least in large respects, going a bit against this. And maybe this also reflects my Dutch perspective, I have to say. We have no constitutional court, and we still have a ban, a prohibition on judicial review of legislation, at least on the basis of the constitution. So I think here the main reason to leave at least a significant leeway to political actors in determining what this identity is I think that when we are talking about constitutional identities, it's often not so clear always what it means. It's not so clear what constitutional ideas are part of it and what are not. And even if then it may be clear, they're often fairly abstract principles. So in Germany, they are democracy or core of human rights and other principles. And there are many, like we already talked about democracy, there are many possible ways in which you can think about that. So a court for me has to have a limited role in saying something about this. And you could say that another really good example, I think, that shows the complications when courts say too much is that, for example, the German Constitutional Court has said like there are democracy something essentially national. I think that's the core of their position. Therefore, substantial competences must remain for the German parliament, the Bundestag. And there's you cannot hollow out those competences to a significant degree. So there is a moment when you would confer too many competence on the EU. And they have said that in the Lisbon judgment, there are certain areas actually which are particularly sensitive. So for example, criminal law, family law, or the budget rights of the Bundestag. And here I think the problem is that this removes in a way political discussion, of course, about which competences you need to transfer to the EU. So if you, for example, so there's good reason to say criminal law is very sensitive, so it should be a national parliament that makes the essential decision on that. But if you could also say, yeah, look, if we have an area without internal borders, and criminals can move wherever, it might mean that at a certain point you need to start thinking about EU criminal law. And actually, it's not so clear where that discussion would end, right? And it's not so clear which sort of aspects of that you have to keep national. And you see similar with budget rights and maybe potentially taxes for the EU. If you say a budget right is so central and taxing is so it goes to the core of democratic decision making and it should be national. And therefore, you're very skeptical of having EU-level taxes. Yeah, that might mean that it's very difficult to do something about tax evasion, or you haven't. It's difficult to fully take into account free movement of capital on the EU. So here, I think you see that once a court start making these kinds of judgments, it risks taking a position in political debates that ultimately will constrain the ability of say, democratically elected politicians to decide these issues.
You already mentioned some examples from the German Constitutional Court, but let us dig deeper into that because it's one of the most important parts of your book. So judicial Euroscepticism is one of the core concepts that you coin in the book based on the analysis, obviously, of this German Constitutional Court. So in what sense the German Constitutional Court was skeptical or is skeptical of the European integration process?
Yeah, so judicial Euroscepticism, it's maybe it was a bit provocative to say it like that. It's a bit cheeky, maybe. I don't know if it's a core concept. So I did a few case studies of the German courts in my book. And one of the issues I looked at is the Maastricht Treaty judgments. So, and my sort of way to explain this Maastricht Treaty judgment or to appreciate it was ultimately as a form of what I said, judicial Euroscepticism. So why did I come to that conclusion? So I think one of the ideas maybe that we have a bit about the Maastricht judgment is that this is of course the first judgment in which the German Constitutional Court used the principle of democracy really to assess the European Union and in the form of the Maastricht Treaty. And what the court did there is say, essentially, I think that democracy is something national. So there are limits to the amount of competences that you can transfer to the EU. We need to be very strict on supervising those competence li limits and the sort of what they call the pre-legal conditions for democracy at the EU level are not yet in existence. And they point there to a shared identity, a common language, and particularly this idea of a public sphere, so common media organizations. Now, there's been, of course, lots of criticism on that judgment, but you could also say, you know, despite everything, it at least gave us a very principled statement about democracy in the EU. So it got this debate about the democratic deficit in the EU going. Now, and then I thought, okay, how have actually the political actors of that time dealt with this question? Did they completely ignore this issue of democracy or did they elaborately discuss it? So I looked at the treaty negotiations as well as the ratification debates in Germany. And what I found more or less is no, you know, democracy was really a major topic. So in the treaty negotiations, there was a disagreement between, I think, roughly the French position and the German position, where the French wanted the more intergovernmental union, and in Germany wanted to strengthen the European Parliament. And the Maastricht Treaty was a sort of compromise between these two different visions, with still a very strong intergovernmental component, which Germany ultimately accepted. Now, and then if you then look at the ratification debates in Germany, you see actually that almost everyone is very disappointed about this fact. So they believe that the EU, the Maastricht Treaty, has a lot of democratic problems because the European Parliament hasn't been strengthened enough, and almost everyone calls for the strengthening of the European Parliament. So a very pro-European vision, you could say, of democracy. Everyone wants democracy, but it needs to be realized on the European level. And they accept the Maastricht Treaty as a compromise. So as a sort of, now, if you then contrast that, I think, with the German courts, I would say what the German court has done is offer this more sort of national perspective on democracy, stressing more the connections between the nation state and democracy, and certain sort of maybe preconditions for democracy. And that I thought is sort of something that you also see in more Euroskeptical discourse. So, right, so this relation between a people and democracy, and the relationship between the nation is something that's very prominent, I think, in more Eurocritical areas. And this is how I then appreciate the German Constitutional Court at that time, that it brings in that this specific perspective. And it's understandable also, I think, in the time, because there were no really no Eurocritical parties in the German parliament at that time. And there are like public opinion polls that showed that maybe citizens had maybe a bit more hesitations about European integration. So I think what happens with the Maastricht judgment is that the court opens up the possibility to challenge measures of EU law and for the treaty acceptances or treaty ratifications, and itself sort of gives a bit more critical perspective on European integration. And this, I say, is a sort of form of judicial Euroscepticism. So it's not, I think, what I try to really is that assert it's the court is not the only institution really offering us a principled debate on democracy. It is giving us a particular vision of that, and a more Eurocritical vision. And so we need to, if we want to understand the German Constitutional Court in relation to the EU, I think that's the way to understand it. And I
Sure.
could say, yeah, how this continued then after Maastricht in the crisis.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you because you also conducted not only the analysis of the ratification debates as such, but also conducted several interviews or tw more than 20 interviews with the official German officials regarding the position of the court and so on. So I was wondering what were your insights of this empirical analysis? What surprised you, or maybe something that surprised you didn't surprise you at all?
Well, I think with the Maastricht, it really did surprise me how democracy was such a central topic. Like, it's really, I think I would really say in the German parliamentary debates, it's really the central topic. It's just really pro-European. And I think if you then, I also looked at the Euro crisis, there I would say, yeah, the court is sort of, the German Constitutional Court, what it does is it's sort of a voice for a Eurocritical parliamentary minority and an extra parliamentary opposition to the EU. And we can sort of understand this in the context of the German political system, where for a long time, I think Euroscepticism was a sort of a political taboo for historical reasons. This is, of course, now has changed because they now have a very clearly Euroskeptical party, very prominent in the parliament. But so what happened, for example, during the crisis, I think, is that you had individual members of parliament within the bigger parties that had a more Eurocritical attitude, such as Peter Gauweiler, for example. And they are, it's not always clear that the parliamentary debates reflects their position so well, because it's the majority of their party has a different position than they. And also the party leadership determines who speaks, for example, in the parliamentary debates. So I think what happens is that these some of these people, at least, then are able to use the constitutional court to sort of set up an extra forum to bring forward these more Eurocritical claims. And the German court is going along to a certain extent with that because of the interpretation they chose at Maastricht. That's my analysis. So in a way, you could say this is somehow more democratic because it does indeed favor contestation, brings in a diversity of viewpoints. But I think the fundamental problem with it is that a court is ultimately, of course, it is in a special position, the constitutional court. It rules about the fundamental constitutional rules that regulate the political game. So if you're going to take a very specific view of those constitutional rules, you are risking to limit that political debate and the diversity of opinions that you have in there. And I guess for me, the most surprising is that, yeah, so this is maybe a bit provocative, but to say that I found that in some ways, the German constitutional court is even a bit like a populist actor, right? So they are legitimating themselves on the voice of the people. There's also really a lot of calls for, or there was a certain point that they said, some of the members at said, you need a referendum to change all this. And that sort of suggests that the Bundestag, which they cherish so centrally in their case law, is actually not representing the people's opinion very well when it comes to matters of European integration, and that it's only sort of the people speaking themselves through a referendum. And I found this a very strange position in a way, because there's hardly any provisions for direct democracy referenda in the German constitution. There was debates about this at the time, for example, of Maastricht, where people said, we don't want extra possibilities for referenda in a German constitution. Why? Because we've explicitly chosen for a representative democracy in light of the Weimar history. And then there's some people on the court that seems to suggest, if you have a simple referendum on the German constitution, you could maybe do away with the entire constitution, even the unamendability clause, and abrogate this order as a whole. So that I found that position very surprising and difficult to understand. And for me, that showed sort of the limitations of this, the kind of difficult spots that the court at a certain point had put itself into. And maybe final point, so reasoning back sort of to the theoretical debate on constitutional courts and judicial review of legislation, my sort of analysis was, this all these sort of findings from how it has worked in practice, it's not so easy to actually fit them in the theoretical debate. So we, in sort of classical arguments for judicial review of legislation, would think of these courts as very sort of principled, reasonable actors. And I think from the empirical viewpoint, I was much more, that's not really what we end up with here. So it really was, for me, really interesting to combine these two sort of different perspectives. Yeah, I hope that sort of answers.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really fascinating to also discover this position of perhaps German judicial fear of democracy. It's also a surprising thing to discover, probably. My last question would regard something, like it will be a question that combines your empirical insights and perhaps the structural solutions to the problem. So how can we design an institutional balance between constitutional courts and the legislature to assess the democratic legitimacy of judicial review? So what is the judicial review understood as participation, as you suggest?
Yeah, so I don't know if I would necessarily call it judicial review as participation. I think in the conclusion, I have sort of two ideas. And I think that these maybe would have to be worked out more by others. So one idea is a sort of minimal democratic review, you could say. So there are, I have also a chapter on how the German Constitutional Court helped strengthen the position of the German parliament in relation to decisions of executives, for example, by demanding more information on European decision making, and also ensuring that the German parliament has a say on certain issues. So I think these are ways to think about a sort of more democratic role for the constitutional courts in a way that would allow deliberation, democratic deliberation and contestation to take place rather than potentially constraining it. So that is a sort of thinking about what are sort of minimal criteria of democracy that the EU sometimes doesn't fulfill. And there, maybe court should really be strong and assertive and say this year here you cannot go. But it should be very careful, I think, in trying to do too broadly. And if there, my sort of analysis is if you want dialogue and contestation, maybe what you need is a court putting certain things on the agenda, but leaving them explicitly to political actors to deal with them. So you could think about if you think again about the Maastricht judgment, you could say maybe the court should have said done something like, okay, it should have said there are different positions in democracy in the EU. Some worry that there's a close link to the nation states and democracy, and others would say no, you need the strengthening of the European Parliament. It could then say, well, what is at least necessary is that these issues are debated seriously within Parliament, but they go beyond the competence of our courts to say something definitely about, because we see that there's reasonable disagreement about these issues. But I'm not 100% sure if a court can do that. I think I don't know if the court's always able to reflect that disagreement so much. So the suggestion I do is that yeah, you could have maybe a weak form of review, so declarations of incompatibility, where court maybe sometimes says we don't think that this issue has been seriously considered, so other actors should consider it seriously. But this is an idea that would require further working out, and I think there are some people looking at that also.
Yeah, thank you. So on this note, we will end. So thank you very much, Nick, for your time and insights on these very complicated matters.
Thanks very much. It was a great pleasure to be here and an honor to discuss my book.
Thank you. And up until the next time.